there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest.
We'll be taking a break from recording new Books with Hooks segments over the summer so that we can recharge our batteries and return fully energized in the fall. We'll still be critiquing two new Books with Hooks submissions each week, though, which our paid Substack subscribers will get every Tuesday through our newsletter. That's until we return with new segments to air in the fall. So continue to submit your queries to us through our website. In the meantime, we'll be kicking it back by playing Books with Hooks episodes from our backlist while still airing brand new author interviews each week.
Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes a award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine deck and deck of worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamurray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Hi everyone, welcome to another Books with Hooks segment. So Carly will look at two and Cece will look at two. All right, Cece, why don't you kick us off?
Dear The Shit No One Tells You About Writing, thank you so much for taking a look at my submission. I love your show. The Gap Year, Adult Fiction, 89,000 words, is an upmarket beach read set during the Great Recession about a young millennial artist trying to outrun grief, but tripping over familial obligations, romantic entanglements, and a mountain of unpaid bills. It is told in a style that mixes the wry realism of Sally Rooney's Normal People with the humor of Jen DeLuca's Well Met. Like Reality Bites for millennials, it's a story of 20-somethings colliding in tragedy, comedy, and romance, and early 2000s nostalgia. 23-year-old Marion Reeves is a person with a future in a coveted spot at a prestigious New England graduate arts program. She's on her way to fulfilling her dreams of becoming a successful portrait painter. But when her beloved father dies of an overdose, she stops painting and gets kicked out of the program. Without a plan, she packs her life into her dad's old Bronco and hits the road, winding up 700 miles away on the doorstep of her best friend, Divya. Marion convinces her grad school to let her back in on one condition. She must finish a portrait series. Easy enough. But uninspiring Raleigh, North Carolina, has more distractions than Marion anticipated. A dead-end coffee shop that she cares more about than she should, a crush on a fellow barista that she just can't shake, of Loveless Affair with the Town's Problematic Rich Boy, and the same creative block that got her kicked out of school in the first place. Now, Marion must untangle herself from these complications before her school's re-entry deadline comes crashing down, and this gap year turns into a gap life. I am the author of the award-winning picture book, The King of the Birds, Groundwood, 2016. Inspired by the life of Flannery O'Connor, I received the Louis Sudler Prize in the Arts for my writing while at Emory University, where I graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from the creative writing program. This is my debut novel. Thank you for your time and consideration. Acri Graham McCam.
Wonderful, Cece. Thank you. All right, why don't you tell us what you thought of that query letter?
Okay, so very, very well-written query letter. Thank you so much for querying us. You mentioned upmarket beach read, and I have to say, I didn't get beach read vibes reading this. Maybe I'm wrong, but it didn't bother me. I just didn't really get beach read vibes. First paragraph, when you mentioned the hook that she's trying to outrun grief and tripping over familial obligations, romantic entanglements, and amount of unpaid bills. My question is, any chance we can focus on the specificity of the hook as opposed to the inner life? Like, for example, in Normal People, and you're using this as a comp, it was the common denominator between the two protagonists. His mom was her cleaning lady, and they went to the same school, which obviously, you know, is a great hook. And, you know, your last sentence of the first paragraph, colliding in tragedy, comedy, romance, early 2000s nostalgia, really interesting, but at the same time, a little vague. So I do recommend leaning into specificity. The plot paragraph is absolutely excellent. Like, excellent, so well written. If there is a way to hint at a power imbalance, that would make it even stronger because it would make it more commercial and you are promising me an upmarket novel. Because as it stands, like I said, super well written. I understand the journey, I understand the pressures and the plot escalation, or I should say the plot points. But there isn't a lot of pressure being applied to the main character. It seems like a quieter novel, which is fine, but if it's upmarket, we will expect a little bit more pace. So yeah, if there's a way to hint at power imbalance, that's a great way to up the tension. And you know, this is a perfect author paragraph, like really, really, really well written.
Wonderful. All right, Cece, will you give us an indication of what was in those opening pages?
The protagonist, Marion, is walking on campus carrying a note that she dreads. The note says, "Marion, please swing by my office after class today. I'd like to have a little chat." Marion knows that it can't be good news because whenever someone says we need to talk, bad things happen. It's how her high school boyfriend initiated breakup talks with her. It's how her dad broke the news that he was divorcing her mom. It's how her mom started the conversation she had months ago when she got her dad's autopsy back. So Marion arrives in school and tries to pay attention to class, but she's really distracted. The professor, and that's the person who wrote the note, approaches Marion's workstation and notices how there hasn't been any progress in Marion's painting in 2 weeks. So then we cut to the professor's office, in which the professor asks Marion, you know, how is she doing? Because Marion is having a hard time delivering assignments and keeping up with the university's expectations. And Marion thinks to herself, maybe I should tell her everything that's going on, but that sounds like a cheap excuse, so she doesn't. And the professor suggests that Marion takes a break, and Marion is horrified. So that's essentially what happens.
Wonderful. Okay, so what was your take on those opening pages?
In terms of the opener, I would focus more on the emotionality and on the dread than on the wind whipping through the flannel shirt and the leaves crunching under the feet. It's really well written, don't get me wrong, but openers should build tension. This is really important. This is very well written. I like that we're discussing someone's artistic side. I like that we're talking about, you know, what is essentially like writer's block, but for artists, for painters. So there's a lot of potential here for inner life. I do think it's quiet. Nothing wrong with quiet if that's the intention, but it goes back to my note when I was reading the query letter, which is if you're promising upmarket, then I need a little bit more pace. If you're looking for ways to up tension, I recommend giving her a misbelief and then having a power imbalance lead to a surprise, disruptive outcome. So for example, she could be under the impression that she was safe from the talk with Deirdre, right? She could be arriving at school being like, I have this horrible note, but it's all good, because she had an arrangement with Travis. Travis promised to add her name to his work. Travis is someone who's in the opening pages. I'm not making this person up. Maybe it was like a group project, I don't know. Except Travis doesn't do that. Travis screws her over, right? Meaning that when she's at the office, she thinks she's safe, but then bam, this new information reaches her and she's in trouble. Now, probably that specific example won't work because it might not be in keeping with her morality. It might not be in keeping with the school's assignments, with the nature of art school, but it's meant to illustrate how you can up the tension. Because right now she walks into that office knowing that it's not good. She's still really shocked by the suggestion of taking a break, which to me didn't really read as believable. And I will also say that I don't think a university would do this. I think a university would have mentioned a break sooner with a warning. Like, if you don't deliver X, we are going to talk probation. We are going to talk, you know, whatever the consequences is. I don't think that someone would first mention a consequence of this gravity and then follow up immediately. There's also another moment where attention could be added. So, you know, if you don't mind me suggesting, there's on page 5, I consider telling her everything right then, but it would have felt cheap, like an excuse, and one that was too late. So I assume this is referring to her dad's death. Probably the professor doesn't know that her dad died. And I like that she's withholding information from the person she's speaking to. That is an excellent source of tension. However, I would like to have another source of tension, which is mystery-based tension from the reader. It seems like the reader knows everything there is to know here. And so, for example, what if she thought to herself, if only she knew that it's not as simple as me having lost my dad. If only she knew the truth about what the autopsy revealed. Now, obviously, this would require there to even be a mystery with the autopsy, but that's something that would make me go, wait, hold on. What truth did her dad's autopsy reveal, and how could that possibly be messing with her head? So that's just an example, but again, I want more tension, but that's what I always want when I read pages, so I'm pretty sure listeners are tired of hearing me say that at this point. There's a lot of potential here, and thank you for sharing.
Wonderful, Cece, thank you. Okay, Carly, will you read us that next query letter?
Dear Carly, I recently discovered your podcast and am devouring it. It's fabulous, thank you. I'm submitting The Museum of Happiness, women's fiction with a romantic subplot, complete at 81,000 words. Because of its themes and humor, this novel would appeal to fans of Kelly Harms, Sophie Kinsella, and Camille Pagan. When goal-driven Lottie chucks life in Seattle to work alongside her longtime boyfriend Emmett at the prestigious Museum of Modern Art, she can't imagine being happier. Until she discovers Emmett's secret. Unable to tolerate working with him, she quits her dream job and scrambles to find another. It's no consolation when she's hired as the director of a new museum, the ridiculous New York City Museum of Happiness. Lottie may not be proud of the director of happiness, but she's not about to fail. People in her family just don't. So with the museum's grand opening deadline looming, Lottie navigates restoring a vandalized museum, negotiating with an unreasonable board member, and recovering from a series of stinging humiliations. Ever been caught at work in the bathroom trying to dry your bra under the hand dryer? With embarrassments piled on her discovery about Emmett, she's slapped with another shock, this time about the father she'd always counted on. So Lottie focuses on the part of life she can kind of control, getting the museum open on time. One thing she knows for sure, it's definitely not the time for a new relationship. Although Bjorn, the chair of the museum's board, seems perfect. I mean, those eyes. Despite comical distraction and heartbreaking betrayals, working at the Museum of Happiness turns out to be just what this perfectionist needs. Lottie learns through the hard work of launching the museum and the insight of quirky co-workers that genuine happiness can thrive in an imperfect life. My first novel, Towards the Corner of Mercy and Peace, will be published summer 23 by Regal House Publishing. I have been a writer and editor for 30 years, primarily for newspapers and magazines, and was the recipient of the Kentucky Press Association's Best Feature Writer and Best Column Awards. My middle grade biography, To Be Greater Than Marconi, the Nathan B. Stubblefield story, was published as part of the Kentucky Hero series by Motes Books. I'm a member of Women's Fiction Writers Association, a writing critique group, and write a lifestyle blog. Thanks so much for taking time to read my submission. I look forward to hearing from you. All the best, Tracy Buchanan.
Awesome, Carly. Thank you. Okay, what was your take on that?
All right. I really love this title, The Museum of Happiness. I just think there's so much packed into this really interesting title and kind of hook of her working in a museum of happiness, even though she's not happy. I think this is really, really, really adorable and eye-catching and unique. Okay, and now for some technicalities. So just starting up with some word choice. So we have when goal-driven Lottie chucks life in Seattle. I don't love the word chucks here. I don't know if it's meaning to be kind of casual, but upending your entire life and kind of moving coast to coast, to me, it's more than chucks. I don't know. That just didn't really seem like the right word choice there. And there's also some assumptions that are made, for example, that everybody knows where the Museum of Modern Art is, because she doesn't say Chuck's life in Seattle to move to New York. She just says, you know, Chuck's life in Seattle to work at the Modern Museum of Art. So that just seemed like a little bit of a leap for me. But a lot of the stuff in this paragraph here otherwise is just a little bit vague. So we have, she discovers Emmett's secret, unable to tolerate working with him. We're kind of missing the why here a little bit. And then we also have another kind of why question, which is, the query says, people in her family just don't, about failing. You know, do we need to know why they don't fail, or what does this mean? Later on in the query, we get the word perfectionist, but we're not really understanding early on if it's perfectionist in the sense of, you know, is she like clinically anxious, or, you know, what is it about the perfectionism that kind of comes into play here? But otherwise, a lot of vagueness. Again, we have, you know, her discovery about Emmett, you know, another shock, this time about her dad, things like that. I think there's some good stuff in here. I liked the Lottie focuses on the part of life she can control, you know, getting the museum open on time. She's not interested in a new relationship, although maybe she is, that kind of thing. And there's a bit of voiciness here, which I think kind of skews towards the women's fiction, which is, you know, the bit about, I mean, those eyes, exclamation mark, is kind of what she's trying to get at, is this swoony moment. So I got that voiciness coming through. If that tone fits the rest of the book, I think that voiciness is fine. But, you know, it did stand out a little bit as possibly too voicey for a query. And then in the last paragraph, I think we can get rid of the entire last paragraph except this line, which is, genuine happiness can thrive in an imperfect life. And I liked that. So I would cut the rest of that paragraph and keep that. And then for the author bio, I think obviously this person's trying to convey their qualifications, you know, things that they've written and awards and things like that. The only thing I think that's a little bit disjointed here is that nothing really has to do with this book. You know, we're not really sure. Obviously, this person says it's their debut women's fiction. They're a member of Women's Fiction Writers Association. So I think in order to kind of combat the fact that, you know, they're kind of launching into this new space, I think I really want to know, maybe, where did this idea come from? Or why is this the book you need to write? Maybe just one line about exactly why this idea came to be, or how you came up with the hook, I think might actually connect this author bio a little bit more to the actual subject matter here. But yeah, it's a really fun little concept and well done on the title.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Will you give us an indication of what was in those opening pages and then tell us your breakdown of that?
All right. So we start off meeting our two main characters. So we have our female main character, Lottie, and her partner, which is Emmett. So basically they're meeting at a restaurant after she has moved across the country. They're kind of having an encounter where he seems pretty stressed. They're kind of sitting down at their table. They're acting kind of awkward around each other, not really in sync at all. And she kind of keeps asking him, you know, are you okay? What's wrong? Are you tense? That sort of thing. And she assumes that she is going to stay with him. She just arrived and this is her long-term partner and long-distance partner. But he says that she's going to be going to stay at Franny's. And Franny is a cousin and close friend who lives in Brooklyn because his place is getting painted. And we're kind of, it doesn't really exactly specify, but it seems to be that she has an allergy to paint. And that's why she can't stay while the painters are there. So she's kind of sent off to stay with the cousin. However, she kind of says like, oh, okay, you know, maybe my allergies won't be too bad. You know, she's kind of fighting it and says she wants to go. And they head off to his place in a car, which in New York City, as most people know, you're going to be using public transit or walking. He has a pretty big vehicle and they're trying to maneuver around New York City with their giant vehicle. So it's really just a setup for an awkward reunion and a tense reunion for this couple. And here's my analysis of our materials. So a lot of this, I think, is that balance between this kind of commercial women's fiction voice, kind of figuring out what is the voiciness, what is the tone, trying to kind of bring in the reader with sympathy and trying to do this dance as a lot of commercial women's fiction books have to do. And so a lot of books in this space, it's simultaneous about leading the reader, but also being entertaining at the same time, because it's very obvious that this couple is going to break up. I mean, they're not in sync at all. You know, they're not able to communicate. They're absolutely not on the same page in any capacity whatsoever. And some of the quirks that she didn't like about him, such as apparently he swears and she doesn't like swearing, is one thing that was mentioned. Like, all he's doing is, you know, swearing. He's in New York City, he's driving, he's cursing. And it just reminds her of how much she doesn't like that about him. So all in all, it's just very obvious these people are going to break up. So this is kind of part of the commercial women's fiction setup sometimes, which is, you know, sometimes we have to have a breakdown in order to rebuild. So a lot of it is feeling a little bit tropey, not necessarily in a super bad way, because sometimes tropes are wonderful. Sometimes tropes are so comforting and, you know, we know what to expect from the book. And as a reader, you know, tropes can just feel comforting to us. So we kind of want to balance that feeling comfortable about this trope and this setup with also being surprising. And so I think I would just try to just just encourage you to just be conscious of that, maybe if you're not conscious of it. And if you are conscious of it, I think one of the things I would try to encourage you to pay attention to is what the dialogue is doing versus what the narration is doing. Because a lot of times, you know, what she's saying is obviously different than what she's feeling. But also there's a bit of a disconnect between a lot of things here. You know, it's the feeling of this character's trying to be connected in this moment, and she's also feeling disconnected. So I'm just not sure how much the creator, you know, the author here is aware of what they're doing versus kind of what I'm pointing out about this. But I just really felt a little bit of a disconnect, which, and I don't want the reader to feel disconnected. That's the big thing for me, right? So even if you're trying to show that these two people are not meant to be together, we don't want the reader to feel distant from them. We still want the reader to feel sympathy for them, whether they are or are not going to get together. So I just wanted the writer to know that you are creating a lot of distance between us. And I think I would try to get to a little bit more sympathy here.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Okay, Cece, let's go to your second query letter. Will you read that for us?
Dear Cece, I am pleased to send you Other Powers, a YA fantasy novel of 100,000 words featuring magical botany, queer longing, and morally complex characters. It will appeal to fans of socially critical fantasy, such as Robert Jackson Bennett's The Founders Trilogy and Netflix's Arcane, and also to readers who enjoy YA with a literary voice, for example, the work of Catherine Arden. 14-year-old Amala is scraping a living, selling herbal remedies when a mage, Olin, appears at her door, looking for someone who can help her germinate some unusual seeds. Realizing this may be her only chance to learn magic, Amala decides to bargain and insists that Olin give her lessons in return. She even begins to hope that she can master the skills necessary to earn entry to the Forbidding Citadel, home to a school of magic for the wealthy and powerful. She soon learns that Olin is wanted for crimes against magic, and that the Citadel's ruthless enforcers are combing the city for any sign of the mage's research. Amala is too determined to become a mage to stop now and grows the seeds in secret, a decision that will cost her everything she knows when Olin's plan finally comes to fruition. Stranded far from home and reeling from the disorienting psychological after effects of Olin's experiment, Amala must find a way to rid herself of her former mentor's lingering influence over her mind before she loses all sense of self. I'm originally from the north of England and currently teach at an international school in South Korea. When I'm not teaching or writing, I'm studying for an MA in Applied English or watching Star Trek. Other Powers would be my debut novel. Thank you for your time and consideration. Kind regards, Jay Rothe.
Wonderful, Cece. Thank you. Okay, what was your take on that query?
So thank you for sharing this query with us. I was really intrigued by the line, magical botany, queer longing, and morally complex characters. So that line is definitely doing its job because I was like, ooh, intriguing. Let's focus on the plot paragraphs since, in my opinion, that is the most important part of the query letter. Paragraph 1, she even begins to hope that she can master the skill necessary to earn a position. Could we change that to something more active? So for example, you know, since she's just starting to learn magic, perhaps her potential is so amazing that she, you know, begins to believe that she has this skill. So, you know, when she excels at the lessons at record speed, maybe she even, you know, manages to be better than Olin in one or two spells, which is unheard of. And that kind of potential is what makes her create this ambition of going to the school. I just wanted it to be more active as opposed to just, you know, a belief or a hope without any indication of why she would believe that. And then the second plot paragraph, I have two big notes. One note is that there's a lot of vagueness, and I'm sure that no one is surprised to hear me say this. A decision that will cost her everything she knows when Olin's plan finally comes to fruition. That's vague. I don't know what that means. And, you know, maybe it's intentional, but I think that we always talk about, you have to give us enough to keep me specifically curious. And I was with the first paragraph because I thought it was going to be a story about, you know, is she going to make it into the Citadel or not? But that's not what happens, at least not according to the second paragraph. Since the Citadel and her entry to the school isn't even mentioned, not in the context of her, right? Like, it is mentioned in the context of Olin. So it's like the second paragraph becomes a totally different book. This plot point, which I was intrigued about, seems to have been forgotten. And the sentences that are included in the second paragraph, disorienting psychological effects of Olin's experiment, a way to rid herself of the lingering influence, I don't know what they mean. So I'm not specifically invested. So my question is the story about her making her way into the Citadel, the school of magic for the wealthy and powerful? If so, then can we just, you know, rephrase the second paragraph, making sure to make it about her and her entry and her journey? And if it's not, then I think that that's misleading in the first paragraph. So it's like we're talking about two different books. I would just revise that and make me feel specifically curious, because that is essential in a query letter.
Wonderful, Cece. Thank you. Okay, can you give us an indication of what was in those opening pages and your take on them?
Amal arrives home from the market and someone is waiting in the stairwell for her. The hooded figure is revealed to be an old woman and, more importantly, a mage. So the mage asks for Amala's mother, but then she's at home, and as the mage is leaving, Amala calls out that her mom will be home tomorrow. So then Amala goes about her routine, we learn things about her world, we see her remembering how when she was a child, her mom would read her bedtime stories, but now that she's 14, she's much too old for that, and, you know, they both have a lot of work to do. She goes to the roof to see the city, including the Citadel, and we get more information on both. And then she thinks about the mage that she saw for like a second as soon as she was arriving home from the market. She also remembers how, as a kid, she used to wonder if her father was a mage until she finally asked her mom, who like laughed and said, no, you're just a regular person like all of us. And then we learn that Amala also recently learned that, you know, the reason why some people live in the Citadel and the reason some do not is money. Because really only mages and students of magic are permitted to enter the Citadel's walls. Magical ability is not something that's inherited or genetic in any way. It's really just acquired through years of study and practice. And so while the cost of that is not known, it is a lot of money. And so it's something that only a few people have access to. So that is what happens in the opening pages. In terms of my notes. So it's really important to start the story in a way that makes us feel incredibly curious. And curiosity thrives when there is tension and emotion. Someone is waiting for Amala when she arrives home from the market, right? Like, I'm paraphrasing, but that is essentially the first line. Is this unusual? Or is her mom, you know, so in demand that there's always someone waiting for her? I wasn't clear because her emotionality wasn't conveyed. Like, I didn't know if this was supposed to be ominous, having someone waiting for her, or if it was just a regular thing. Or even if it wasn't a regular thing, if she wasn't scared, because it's not that kind of place. It's a hooded figure waiting for her, right? So, I don't know. I think that that should have been clearer. And when she does realize that it's a mage, the emotional calibration is off. Because she realizes it's a mage, there's a whole conversation, and then we get her shock. Right? Like, the fact that a mage is there in the outskirts of the city is not only unprecedented, but unthinkable. If it is that shocking, that is the first thing that we should see, since visceral emotions have to come before any type of explanation, any kind of dialogue, any kind of anything. Visceral emotions do not wait for any type of intellectual thinking. This need for more emotionality kept happening. And I want to say that, like, there's a lot of potential here. The query letter promised me that this would appeal to readers who enjoy, I think it was socially critical books or something like that. I forget exactly what the line is. And, you know, it's true based on the hook. The fact that magic isn't something that's genetic, isn't something that just happens, but rather is something that only the wealthy have access to is so interesting. But in order for me to be interested, not just in the concept, but in Amala herself, I need more access to her internal life with tension as opposed to information on the city. So we have a lot of lines here. I highlighted some of them. That's just context. So for example, Tessa's homeland was an expanse of forested marshland away to the south that city dwellers disparagingly called the swamp, but that its inhabitants called Ethys. Ethesian mythology was populated with deities that ruled over the natural world, shape-shifting at will between their human and animal manifestations. Sefti was one such deity, an insatiably curious, good-natured meddler, etc., etc. This is not badly written at all. Maybe someone's thinking, oh, is it because my writing isn't good? That's not it. It's because it's explanation. Explanation kills tension. It's not specific to the character. It's not personal. And more importantly, it's not making me wonder, ooh, what's going to happen next? And that's what I mean. There was just a lot of chores happening, a lot of her mundane day-to-day activity. And we need two lines about that at most. So as well, towards the end, she's thinking about the mage again, and she's not really adding anything to the encounter, with the exception of the memory about her father. But since that was just something that she supposed and not something that's actually true, don't really think it's adding anything. Even if it does turn out to be true and this was just a curiosity seed, I still think we can do more than have her thinking to herself. Personally, I think, big picture note, a lot of explanation. It's killing the tension. And it doesn't help that she's alone. It doesn't help. This is essentially, with the exception of that very brief encounter, just her going about her day. So I would revise where you're starting the story.
Wonderful, Cece. Thank you. Okay, Carly, will you read us that last query letter?
Dear Ms. Waters, thanks to you, Cece, and Bianca for such a practical, useful, and entertaining podcast. It became my favorite podcast immediately. I am working my way through all the previous episodes. There is something I can use in every one. Please consider The Arsonist Returns, a mystery set in a small coastal South Carolina county, which is complete at 72,700 words. When a prominent attorney is shot and the prosecutor's wife goes missing, new sheriff Sonny Campbell must discover if these crimes and the return of a man Sonny put away for arson early in his career are related, or if the apparent link is merely smoke covering other evils. Fans of Michael Connelly and Harlan Coben will enjoy this book. Sonny is a cop that cares, investigating people in his small county who have kept dark secrets from their close friends and family. Sonny is thrust into the sheriff's job after the sitting sheriff gets suspended. Sonny's first case is the shooting death of the suspended sheriff's brother-in-law. The only suspect is the ex-sheriff's sister. Sonny doesn't believe that it was an accident. At the same time, Anne, the wife of the prosecutor and Sonny's best friend, disappears. All this coincides with the return to town of a recently paroled man, Junior Watson, whom Sonny years ago sent to prison for arson. Junior is quickly connected to both crimes. Sonny's attempts to capture Junior for questioning are thwarted when Junior is killed in a downtown gunfight. Hoping to find Anne still alive, Sonny discovers that Junior was investigating the multi-million-dollar real estate development that was erected on the site of the historical building Junior was convicted of burning. Sonny picks up the trail and uncovers a conspiracy that leads him to Anne's unsuspected murder. While I do not have any formal training in creative writing, I am an attorney with some experience in criminal defense. Additionally, I have received instruction and guidance from several independent editors who have assisted me with this novel and my first self-published novel, The Pursuit of Justice. I am the co-author of a nonfiction work, Blended Family Bliss. Included below are the first 5 pages of The Arsonist Returns. Yours truly, Ben.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Okay, what was your take on that?
All right, so the title here is in lowercase and an underline. I would always suggest that you do titles in all caps. I find that it stands out much better and really pops off of the screen. So that's a technical piece of advice. I would also say that we would round our word count. That's another thing we recommend on the podcast. So this is 72,700. I would just, you know, round up to 73,000, keep it easy like that. I found a lot of this query really wordy. I don't know if you guys saw me stumbling a little bit. There's a lot of like SS. SS kind of like shooting, death, suspended, sheriff's sister, Sonny, like over and over in the line. So I would probably just recommend you either hear me read this aloud a few more times or also just read it aloud yourself, because there's a lot of times when things were just wordy. For example, at the top here, it says a small coastal South Carolina county. You know, is there an easier way to say that? There probably is, you know, just give it a shot. Things like that. I would also recommend that we move our comps up a little bit. They feel a little bit tucked in lower. They're kind of tucked in between two plot points. The other thing is, you know, Michael Connelly, Harlan Coben, these are huge brands. I would probably pick, if there's a particular book of theirs that you think that this one aligns with. They're just, again, these are huge, huge brand name authors, which isn't a problem necessarily, but I would probably just, again, try to find something that aligns a little bit more closely with this particular work, instead of saying, you know, I see myself as a fellow brand name author, which that's great. I hope we all aspire to that, but let's just get a little bit more, you know, a little bit more to the fine point here when we're addressing this in our query letter. I would cut this last line. I think there's a typo in it. I tried to read it probably 3 times when we're recording here and I kept stumbling, but I would remove this last line from the second paragraph, the Sonny is a cop line. I don't think that one's working. So next, in our kind of main body paragraph, we have a lot of this again, stumbling over words, and it's quite complicated with the number of people. That's one of my recent complaints and queries, is I'm just seeing a lot of people introduced, and we really just need to be clear about who is the main character and why does this particular story matter to this main character, because we're introducing, you know, the sheriff's brother-in-law, you know, suspects, you know, the wife of the prosecutor, Sonny's best friend, Junior Watson, the paroled man. Like, we're naming so many people, which really makes this skew more like a synopsis than it does a query letter. So I really think we need to rework this. Can we simplify it? Can we make it smoother? And why does this all matter to Sonny himself? Which is really critical to why this book matters in this context. So I would probably rework most of this. Again, read it out loud a number of times. You probably heard me stumble on the podcast reading it because I did find it tricky to get through. Overall, though, I think, you know, your background, you know, you're an attorney with some experience in criminal defense. This is wonderful, wonderful context. Agents love to know that you have that type of experience because it just gives such kind of color and life to the actual subject matter, knowing that you know something about this. So I think that's all great, but you probably need to rewrite your query. Sorry, Ben.
Thanks, Carly. And as someone who's currently watching The Thing About Pam, the courtroom scenes there are giving me absolute chest pain. So, okay, will you give us an indication of what was in those opening pages and then your take on them?
Here we go. All right. So we right away are launched into the crime scene. So the first line is, Sonny hadn't been to a crime scene since his wife died. Some said he wasn't the same. It was time to find out if they were right. So we're launched right into this crime scene moment. He's walking in. There is, you know, tropical storms. It says, you know, bursts of tropical rain. We're understanding like there's a, you know, a potential hurricane coming, or there's a hurricane that just happened. So we have like very intense weather and a very intense crime scene, which is basically, we're told, a dead man lay on his back, illuminated by temporary spotlight. You know, so we're aware that there's a dead person here. So we're really just talked through the scene because the cop is basically showing up. So we're getting walked through the whole thing. So we have, you know, the tech explaining what's happening. And then we're finding out the actual crime itself, which is this wife shot her husband point blank in the head because she believed that he was an intruder coming into their house, but really it was the husband coming home. And so we're getting all of that. We're also, the tech is kind of advising us on the scene. We also have the suspended sheriff show up, which was a very interesting, complicating factor here, because the wife who shot the husband, the first person that she called was this ex-sheriff. So we're kind of understanding how related this small town is, how, you know, how everybody is connected, which obviously makes things really interesting. And then we find out that he is planning on sitting in on the interview. So this ex-sheriff who has been suspended wants to sit in on the interview as, you know, a friend to the wife. And basically our sheriff is saying, absolutely not. You know, this is my crime scene. I'm kicking you out. And then people are debating whether this is in fact a murder or whether this is in fact an accident. So that's kind of where we're at. And so my analysis of this is basically that it feels extremely cinematic because we're walking right into this scene. You know, we know where we are. We're kind of like beachfront, hurricane. You know, we can really see what's happening in this crime scene because we're being walked through it. And so it functions as a really good job of introducing us to the scene, but it also feels really natural because any, you know, sheriff walking into the scene would need to be kind of talked through from the tech, but the tech is kind of also explaining the scene to us. So I actually really liked that. However, we do start getting pretty technical and we start losing some kind of characterization because we don't actually know anything about our current sheriff, because all he's doing is kind of observing the scene and being talked to. He is put in an interesting situation when this former sheriff comes up, his kind of ex-boss, who he kind of takes the place of because he was suspended. You know, that obviously introduces some complicating factors. And we also find out that our sheriff's wife had died and it was from a swimming incident. And we kind of get the sense that, you know, he wasn't able to rescue her. He went out to kind of get her and he didn't make it. And so that's kind of thrown in his face a little bit. So that's the one element where we actually understand a little bit about Sonny, our sheriff character. But other than that, it's mostly about everybody else. And so I don't think it's overly problematic. I just want you to be aware of that. But there is a lot of tension here. Tension between, you know, is this a murder or not a murder? Who's in charge of this crime scene? So many, again, interesting layers here. So I think you're starting in the right place. It feels right. But maybe just be aware that it does feel like you're kind of walking us through the crime scene, possibly a little bit too long. And we just kind of want to get to the drama as quickly as possible. So I think that your pages are way, way, way stronger than your query letter is. I don't think your query letter is doing this project justice. So go back and rewrite it.
Wonderful, Carly. Right, now let's go to today's guest.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them, and that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally, first with words and then with phrases and then sentences, and it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer it for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.
Today's guest writes stories about messy girls, mayhem, and murder. Dun, dun, dun. When she's not busy pondering the angst of fictional people, she can be found reading from her own TBR as well as her children's, dreaming of restoring an old French chateau, and wandering the weirder parts of New Jersey, where she currently resides with her family. Girls Who Burn is her debut novel, and it's my pleasure to welcome MK Pagano. MK, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you here. You were one of the authors who caught my attention more than a year ago as you were posting about debuting. And that's always, for me, the most exciting time of an author's life is as you are building up to debut. There's just so much that comes with it. It's a very fraught time as well, and hopefully we can discuss that. But it's so exciting that your book is about to be coming out into the world.
Yeah, tomorrow, as of the time of this recording.
Yeah, I think we're going to air a little bit after it comes out, but still very, very exciting. Right, so for our listeners, before we get into the weeds of everything, I'm going to read you the jacket copy for Girls Who Burn. It is such a beautiful cover. You know, these days there are so many covers that look like other covers. I know that publishers go, oh, what kind of book are we comping this to? And they'll look at those covers and they kind of come up with a composite of those covers. This one is just really gorgeous. If you stare at it, there's smoke that looks like a ballet dancer coming out of the chimney. Really, really eye-catching. So for our listeners, we will be linking to that in our newsletter, and we're linking to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. So go have a look there to see what a really, really striking cover looks like. Right, so here is our flap copy. 18-year-old Addie Blackwood regrets nothing more than one horrible, mistake-filled night last summer.
Hours after she hurled the worst words she could think of at her sister, Fiona was dead at the bottom of a ravine. The police ruled her death an accident, but Addie's never bought it. Her ballet prodigy sister didn't slip and fall, she was pushed. And Addie's number one suspect, Thatcher Montgomery, the rich kid down the street who always had a thing for Fiona. But when Thatcher is found dead in the same ravine, Addie misadmits she was wrong. And now her only ally and alibi in catching the real killer is none other than her childhood rival, Seth Montgomery, Thatcher's cousin and the boy she's always loved to hate. Arguing with Seth is easy, working with him without thinking of that night last summer, near impossible. As Addie and Seth dodge corrupt police and his even more corrupt family, their investigation pulls them closer than ever before. But as they approach the explosive and murderous truth, their growing bond may not be enough to keep Addie safe. In fact, it may turn her into the next victim. In this twisty, pulse-racing, enemies-to-lovers thriller, the only thing that burns hotter than the long summer days is Addie's rage and desire. So as you can hear, really a lot going on there, so much to break down. Before we get into that, MK, could you take us through your journey to publication? Tell us about it.
Sure. So this was actually, it's my debut novel, but it's not the first book I've written. I wrote 5 other books before this book. I actually had a different agent before my current agents who sold this book. I got an agent with the second book I wrote, and that was in 2018. We parted ways in 2020, and I was writing in YA contemporary, and I thought that was where I was going to stay. But the book that I was out with on submission with my first agent unfortunately died on submission in 2019 and again in 2020. And I thought it was a contemporary, but the rejections I got, which were glowing rejections, all said, "This is too quiet for a thriller." And that was confusing to me because I didn't think I'd written a thriller, but it really kind of got my mind turning, like, oh, what would happen if I actually set out to write a thriller, which I didn't with that book. And so as those rejections were rolling in, that's when I got the idea for Girls Who Burn and started just kind of tinkering with it, because the first agent I was with was very much an agent who really only dealt in contemporary. So I wasn't sure how she'd feel. And sure enough, when I was like, I think I want to write a thriller, that was kind of when we both realized, like, oh, I don't know if this is the right fit. And that was actually a huge blow, like, because it was the first agent I ever had, the second time I'd queried, first agent I ever got. And to be suddenly agentless again, it felt like this huge step back. But she did me a huge favor by kind of initiating that conversation, because we weren't the right fit. And by setting me free to finish my thriller, which is very much a thriller, it freed me up to find agents that are the right fit for me. So I finished writing this in early 2021, and then it went through a lot of critique partners. It was my third time querying after having been agented. I was determined that it was going to be the best it could possibly be. So I sent it to everyone I've ever met, every writer, just to get as much feedback as possible, which of course takes time. I edited it probably 10 times and then started querying in the summer of 2021. And the difference querying this time is that I had already had so many connections in the writing community. I was a mentee in Author Mentor Match, and then I was a mentor in Author Mentor Match, and I made so many friends through that. So the difference this time was I was able to query, not a lot, but I'd say like 3 or 4 agents on referral, because I knew their clients. And the agent I ended up signing with, Barbara Powell, and actually I have 2 agents, Sydney Thornton is also my agent. They were both at Irene Goodman at the time. They've since broken off to form their own agency, Word One Literary. And she was a referral of a referral. But I don't want people thinking they need referrals to get an agent. I actually ended up with 4 agent offers this time, which I was so excited, because I'd only gotten one the last time and I wasn't expecting it. It did take about 6 months. People were reading slower in 2021 than they were in 2018. 2 of them were completely cold queries. 2 of them were referrals. Most of the agents I queried were cold queries. But yeah, the offer came in from Barbara first, and then I notified the other agents and ended up with 4 offers. I ended up narrowing it down to 2 based on fit and editorial vision and all that. And then it was really hard, because I had these like 2 top agents, great sales record, clients had amazing things to say about them, love their editorial vision, but they had different strategies in terms of submission. I ended up going with Barbara, obviously, we did an exclusive submission to my editor where the agent I didn't end up going with, their idea was to do a wide submission and create an auction. And I didn't know what was best. I wasn't sure what to do. I ended up flipping a coin. And when it landed on Barbara in Sydney, I felt this sense of like relief. And that's how I knew. I was like, okay, I think my gut is telling me these are the right agents for me. And we revised for, I think, only a few weeks. They're brilliant editorially. So I didn't have to kind of argue with them or anything over what they wanted me to change with the manuscript. And they had already had a relationship with my editor, Caitlin Tutterow at Penguin Teen, Nancy Paulson Books, and they knew she was looking for YA thrillers, and she just ended up being the perfect fit for me. Of course, an exclusive submission, there are like some slight downsides, like you're never going to get to go to auction if you're doing an exclusive submission. You don't know what else could have happened, who else might have offered, but I don't regret my decision at all. Also, exclusive submissions come with a hard deadline. And so my book was sold in 2 weeks, which I did not think was possible in the current environment. And yeah, I've been working with Caitlin on it ever since. This was in the spring of 2022, and it is coming out now, summer 2024.
Yeah, boy, publishing is slow. It's glacial until it's hurry up, hurry up. We need everything. You won't hear from your publisher for months on end, and then suddenly they need everything in like the space of 2 weeks, and then you won't hear from anybody again for ages. So yeah, it does work out that way. But there's so much to love and unpack here. One was that you were building community in between writing the books. Two, as emerging authors, we tend to feel that the pinnacle is getting that agent. It's like, once I have my agent, that is the best I could hope for, and everything falls into place. And I think it is important to hear stories like this and to say that sometimes it doesn't work out, and it may feel the most devastating thing in the world at that time. But as you say, it's kind of a gift that you were given.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's not even a story of like a bad agent. There are people who have those stories too. This was a great agent that just wasn't the right fit for me. And I'm very grateful to her, like I said, for realizing that, because I don't think I would have just voluntarily left because I had never had an agent before. I'm not going to leave them. But she realized it and she set me free, and it was the best thing that could have happened to me.
Yeah. And something else you said there that I'd love for us to discuss is that you had a ton of beta readers on this one because you wanted it to be as polished as it can be. Now, anyone who listens to me on the podcast knows I do beta reader matchups. I think it's integral that as writers, we get eyes on our work, that we get all different opinions, different views as we polish it up. But sometimes that can lead to overcorrection in the wrong way. You know, I've done manuscript evaluations with people where I'm like, why didn't you rather begin it this way? And then they'll say, oh, I did begin it this way, but then my beta readers didn't like it. And so they didn't like one particular thing. And so I completely overcorrected and I went the other way. So what was your experience in terms of getting that many eyes on the manuscript? Was there ever times where you were getting completely contradictory feedback and you had to be, MK, you are the person who wrote this. You need to go with how you feel.
Yes, that definitely happens with everything I write. There were some overcorrections I made. Like, I think one person told me there were too many flashbacks to their childhood. In my debut, Addie and Seth have known each other since they were little kids, so they have this long history. They said it slowed down the pacing, so I ended up taking out a lot of the childhood stuff. And then when I started working with my editor, she's like, we need more of their history. We need more childhood stuff. And I was like, oh, easy. I have those scenes already written. Let me just put them back in. But I did also get a few comments that it was a little too romance heavy. There's a very strong romance arc in my thriller. And I had one person who was a seasoned writer being like, if you end up submitting this to my editor, she's going to make you cut out this romance. She thinks it needs to be focused on the thriller. And that scared me because I love my romance. I didn't want to cut it out. I think it's a huge part of my main character's character arc. So I ended up not cutting it at all. And I actually got that feedback from a couple of agents when I queried. They said, you can't put this much romance in a thriller. And I didn't take it out. I just kept querying because I knew that I needed it. And fortunately, I found agents who love that aspect of the book. I found an editor who loved that aspect of the book. So I think it's just a matter of kind of trusting yourself and also keeping the previous versions of the book on your computer in case you need to go back and put them back in, for sure.
That's so important. Don't delete anything, people. Every time I delete something, I end up needing it and then I get all worked up. So just keep it somewhere or the other. So what I love is, you know, the marketing and PR copy of this calls it a YA whodunit thriller. So we've already got sort of cross elements here. Why whodunit thriller? Plus we've got the enemies to lovers trope as well in the thriller. So when you sent that query letter, how were you positioning it there? And like, what were your comps when you first went out?
I'm not great at comps. I think I used Two Can Keep a Secret by Karen McManus, which is a little older now. I mean, I was querying this 3 years ago now. I think I actually used In the Woods by Tana French, which is not a great comp because it's an adult thriller. But I said the atmosphere of In the Woods because this does take place in like a creepy woods. And Tana French is my favorite writer in the entire world. So she's a huge influence on me. I'm not at her level, but maybe someday. But yeah, and then I did kind of do the opposite of what some people wanted me to do. And I positioned it as a romantic thriller, made the romance part of the marketing, part of the query, rather than try to downplay it, because I knew that there would be some people who didn't like that, but they were not the people I was aiming for in the first place. And we did make it a big part of the marketing push. And I think the funny thing is, I've seen other thrillers crop up with these big romance arcs. Like, I think Penguin Teen did a whole slide that was like the rise of the thrillmance. And so it's not just me who is writing this, which I think is really cool. It's kind of, I don't know if it's become more acceptable or there's just something in the zeitgeist, because, you know, romanticy is a thing now, so why can't thrillmance be a thing, you know?
I love that, thrillmance. I mean, we're just seeing how well romance is doing as a genre, so it makes sense that it's going to bleed into other genres. There's nothing to say that a book can't straddle multiple genres, and if enough authors do it, then it becomes its own genre, which is awesome. Now, something I want to chat about when it comes to YAs is something that I know a lot of emerging writers struggle with, is deciding on the age for their main character. Because if they make them like 21 or 22, then we go into new adult territory. And some people say that isn't a genre. But then I've read an article recently that said new adult is making a comeback. So honestly, who the hell knows? But when it comes to deciding on the age of your protagonist, I mean, there's a big difference between making your character 16 and making your character 18. When you sat down, how was it that you decided that Addie was going to be 18? Was it a very considered approach to it, so that certain things in the story could happen? Could you take us through that?
Sure. So I think I wanted to start it at a period in Addie's life where she's trying to put all of this behind her. I'm also really interested in like the in-between spaces in life. I think that's why I tend to set things in the summer, because it's kind of this nebulous place, especially for young people, because it's between one school year and another. And so I chose to set this in the summer between high school and college, which would necessarily make Addie 18 or possibly 17. But I really wanted it to be in this space where she's like, all right, I'm trying to leave my old life behind. I'm trying to leave my childhood behind. I'm trying to move on. Like, her sister has died. She's tried to bring the killer to justice. She's failed. So she's at the very beginning, she's like, I'm just trying to get through the summer. I'm going away to college. I'm going to be done. And then Seth comes back to town. She's forced to confront her past with him. She's forced to confront everything that she never confronted before, kind of being dragged back into everything from her childhood. And I just think 18 was the perfect age to do that, because it's such an in-between age and like just on the cusp of childhood and adulthood. So yeah, that was a very considered decision. And I made Seth 19 because I wanted him to be a little bit older, but obviously not too much older if they've grown up together in this very close relationship their whole lives.
Yeah, all good points. And also, you want to give your characters a certain amount of freedom that they can get away with certain things, right? Because if they're too young and they've got parents around, I think that's why people go with the orphan trope, because the orphan is a child who is kind of unsupervised. You know, there's no helicopter parenting, which means they can be running around. You know, that's people's ideas of an orphan, which is why the trope is so popular. But as well, if you're writing about sex and things like that, I think people start to feel very uncomfortable if you've got younger characters who are having sex. So I think these are all things for our YA listeners to factor in, you know?
Yes, and I did have, slight spoiler, there is a sex scene in this book that's very YA appropriate. But also, yeah, I did want these characters to kind of be able to reach that point. And not that you can't do it younger, but having them be 18 and 19 made it a little, I think, easier to write and maybe less pearl clutchy for people, if that's the kind of people that are reading this. But yeah, for sure, that's a good point.
Pearl clutchy, I love it. It tends to, when it comes to this, people are either complaining that there's way too much spice, or they're complaining that the spice wasn't spicy enough. There's a very few people who seem to fall into the, oh, this was just the right level of spice category. So I think if you're writing romance, you're going to come up against that time and time again. In terms of your approach to first versus third person, you know, I've read studies that say a lot of debuts naturally fall into the first person voice. I know for my debut, I did that as well. For you, was it just this was a voice that felt natural to you, or was it a very considered approach as to making her first versus third person?
I never even really considered third for this story. I think I just wanted it to be very immediate. I wanted you to be very much in my main character's head. It's only her point of view in this story, and she's so angry, and she's so angsty, and she's so just kind of on the verge of all these things. I wanted that very close point of view that you're in her head. And I think it works really well for the story because it's told very much through her lens and is very much shaped by her experiences. And I think you can do that in third, but it's a little harder. So I think first was definitely the right decision.
Yeah, 100% agree. There was a sense of claustrophobia as you were reading her, you know, being so much in her thoughts, in her head. It gave a great sense of her. And like you say, the whole sort of claustrophobic feel of the woods and everything else, you know, so it came in even more. Were there ever instances where you hit up against sort of obstacles or challenges by writing in the first person and going, oh man, Addie wouldn't know this. How do I now need to figure out how she can know this? Does she have to overhear this from somewhere? Does she have to be hiding somewhere? Because these are things that as emerging authors, we need to consider. The pros and cons when we're doing first versus third, remember in third person, the narrator can tell people things that the character doesn't necessarily know, so long as it's not a close third person. Or if you have multiple characters, it allows for a more 360 view. But when you only have one MC, it's great because we get to spend 80,000 words with them and really get to know them. But there will be instances when you, as the storyteller, are frustrated by their limitations. So, MK?
Yeah, for sure. There's a scene, it actually happens in the past, doesn't happen on the page in this story, where she overhears something. And that is kind of the catalyst for her accusing the rich boy, Thatcher, for killing her sister. And I was like, well, how's she going to do that? I think I had an earlier draft where she's reading her sister's journal. And then I was like, well, that's kind of a crappy thing to do. I'm not going to have her do that. So I changed it to her overhearing something. But I think for my story, it actually worked because there's a very, not a huge cast of characters, but there are a lot of characters. And at one point, she's suspicious of almost everybody. And if I had included a point of view of, say, Seth, her love interest, her being suspicious of him, if we were in his head, we would have known for sure whether or not he was guilty. So I think it worked just having her point of view so that I could make her be like, well, what's that person doing? What are they thinking? And the reader doesn't know either. But yeah, in terms of that, I definitely had to lay the clues very carefully, make sure there weren't too many coincidences. Like, you can't have a character accidentally overhearing something constantly, because that gets to be a little like, that's a coincidence there. And then in terms of like what the police investigation was, I had to have that be something that someone else told her that they had overheard or seen something about. So I think it's just a matter of plotting carefully, outlining carefully, and making sure everything makes logical sense. And then, of course, getting beta readers and your editors weigh in, because sometimes you're just so caught in your own head, you can't see when you've made a giant plot hole. So that's why I think, especially in thrillers, having a lot of beta readers is important, because they catch things that other people don't.
Yeah, there's nothing worse as a writer than you getting to the end of something and either you finally spotted yourself or one of your beta readers spot something and they're like, yeah, but why couldn't they have just have done this? Or this doesn't make sense for this reason. And you're like, oh my God, I did not think about that. And then you quickly got to backpedal and fix it. But that is why getting other eyes on it is so important. And yeah, that mirrors the human experience. You know, we can only ever make theories about what other people are thinking and what they're doing based on their behavior. A show that I have become quite addicted to against my will is the show Traitors. Have you watched that, MK?
I'm obsessed, yes.
Yes. And what makes me so obsessed about Traitors is that a group of people will get together and posit a theory about a third person's guilt or innocence based purely on like how they reacted to something, if they were quiet or if they got loud or if they swallowed water or did not swallow water. And it made me realize, you know, how many times we are completely wrong because we're using very unobjective criteria to reach decisions.
Yes, I love that show. I started watching it recently because people said it's like the mafia game, and I love the mafia game. My family has been playing that since I was younger. Well, we play the werewolf version, but yeah, I think it's interesting that the show chooses to show you what's going on with everyone. Like, you know who the traitors are from the beginning, so you can watch everybody make all the mistakes. And I actually thought about, I was like, is there a way to write a thriller that way where the audience is in on it, but the characters aren't? And I haven't figured it out yet, but it would be interesting, I think.
Yeah. So for our listeners, great show to watch in terms of like groupthink and how people can convince each other of someone's innocence or not. I mean, one woman in the New Zealand version became obsessed with the one guy is a Dungeons and Dragons master. And she was like, he has to be, he's a big game player. So his strategy, we have to watch him. And someone else was like, I really don't care about that. That doesn't show, you know, innocence or not. But we can get in our heads and sort of spiral in terms of our thinking. So that's a great way to see how people react in these instances. Right. You said about a lot of peripheral characters. So you need it in a whodunit, right? Because if you've just got four main characters and one of them's trying to figure out who's the one who murdered it, there aren't a heck of a lot of suspects. So how do you balance that out? Having enough suspects, but not confusing the reader so much that they're like, who the heck is this again?
I think you have to remember that everyone needs a reason to be in the story and not just because they're the murderer. Like in this story, I have her brother, I have her brother's girlfriend, I have her father, I have Seth's cousin, I have his parents, I have her ex-best friend, and they're all there for organic reasons. So I think I've come across it a few times where I'm reading a book where a certain character shows up and I'm like, this person doesn't need to be in the story. And then I'm like, oh, I bet they're the murderer. And then that kind of gives it away. So you have to make sure that every character has a reason for being in that story, that they have a plausible reason for being there other than I'm the murderer, that their connection to your main character is organic and not just kind of hovering there, like waiting to commit crime. And that's actually hard in a thriller. I think with the second one I've written since then, I had to do a little extra work because people are like, what do you need this character for? And I was like, oh, that character's not there organically. I need to find a way to integrate them into this story that makes it seem like they're supposed to be there. And then I think I also just count the characters. I forget what the sweet spot is, but I know if I'm going like over that sweet spot, I think it's like 8 or 9, like really kind of important characters. If I'm going over that, it could get confusing. If I'm going under that, I feel like there's not enough red herrings. So I think it's just a matter of practice and reading a lot. I read a lot of thrillers, so that helps too.
And it really helps to differentiate your characters. You know, if you have them be different ages, different occupations, different motivations, then it's clearer in, you know, a reader's head. The last book I wrote had 6 characters who were all witches and who were all 80 years old. And that was bloody difficult to differentiate them because they're all women, they're all 80, and they're all witches. Whereas if you've got a more sort of a bigger cast and some people are parents and some people are cousins and some people are, you know, younger or older, it really does help differentiate that. Last thing, MK, because our time is running out, I've absolutely loved chatting to you, is I'd like to kind of dig into your advice for people who might be heading for the debut experience or who are dreaming of debuting. Because the one thing I've said on this podcast is that the goalposts shift constantly. I remember when I didn't have an agent, all I wanted was an agent. I was like, I'll just be happy if I get an agent. Then I was like, I'll just be happy if I can get a book deal. Then it was like, well, but now I've got the book deal and I'll just be happy if the book sells really well. And you debut always with a whole bunch of other people. Each year has got its debuts within a particular genre, within a particular publisher or certain niche. And writers, the best writers, support each other. But it can be difficult because you're being compared and you're seeing other people's sales, etc. So as someone who is really in the thick of it right now, what is your advice to people who are either going through it soon or who dream of being there one day?
I would say definitely find your group chat. I mean, the debut group chat has been great. I've met some great people through it. but it's a little bit like The Blind Leading the Blind because we're all debuts. No one knows what they're doing yet. We're all comparing our experiences like, is this normal? Is this normal? And also in publishing, sometimes there is no normal. One publisher does it one way, one publisher does it another. Same with agents. I've heard people swear up and down, this is the way this is supposed to go. And then someone else be like, nope, this is the way this is supposed to go. So I think having other writer friends outside that debut group chat is also very helpful. Ideally, people who are a little ahead on the ladder than you are. I'm lucky enough to be in a group chat with a few bestsellers who've been publishing for a decade or so. And their experience and what they bring to the table. Like I'll hear something in the debut chat and then I'll go to the other chat, be like, hey, does this make sense? And they'll be like, well, that could happen for some people. It doesn't necessarily need to happen for you. I think also just keeping in mind that like, it's not a contest. Like unless you're Stephen King, there's always going to be somebody who's more successful than you. I don't think my goal in publishing a book is to be the number one writer in the world. And so obviously there's going to be people selling better than me. There's going to be people whose books I think are not as good selling better than me. There's going to be people whose books I think are better than mine not selling as well as me. It's not really a meritocracy. I think just keeping in mind publishing is not fair. It's not designed to be fair. There's always going to be somebody who has something that you want. There's always going to be somebody who wants something that you have. And just kind of leaving all that at the door as much as you can and finding people that you consider genuine friends who you want the best for them, they want the best for you, and spending more time talking to those people than to the people you kind of don't know as well. I think just having that strong group around you, I think helps. And also just kind of taking a step away from the computer also helps. I'm lucky that I have two small children that if I'm getting like caught up in my head over are my numbers good enough? Are my pre-orders good enough? Like one of my kids will get sick or need me to play Barbies with her. And then I'm like, you know what? That's not important. This is important. My family is important. The people I care about is important. My writer friends are important. Also, I've been lucky enough, it's taken me a while to get here. So that has let me build up my community, but I'm not 25. I am in my 40s now. And so I kind of feel like going through this all in my early 20s, which is when I originally wanted to start selling books and whatnot, I don't think I would have been as equipped to handle the ups and downs as well as I am now. But there are pros and cons to that. I know plenty of people in their 20s who are doing just fine too. So it just, I think it's a matter of grounding yourself as best as you can.
Yeah, I love that because, you know, it's so easy to go down that rabbit hole of refreshing your Goodreads every hour and refreshing Amazon and checking what people are saying about you and searching for your name. And it is important to put it into context and to be able to step away from it sometimes. That's certainly the much healthier approach. MK, it was so lovely chatting with you. For our listeners, Girls Who Burn, we are linking to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. We will also have it in our newsletter. If you aren't subscribed to our newsletter, you absolutely must be. Our Friday editions are for free, and our Tuesday editions have got tons of extra content, and those are for paid subscribers for $8 a month. We wish you so much success with this title, and we hope to have you back for your next book.
Thank you so much, Bianca. I had such a great time chatting with you.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program, and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Litera Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Litera Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine deck and deck of worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.